Welcome everyone to our Vita DAO panel discussion on applied longevity medicine. I'm Max, your host, and I'm very excited to have two experts entering the world of longevity medicine with me today. From Shanghai, we have actually Professor Evelyn Bischoff joining us. Thank you very much for staying up so late and spreading the word on longevity medicine. She is the Chief Associate Physician at Renshi Hospital and a professor at Shanghai University and focuses on longevity medicine. I'm also very happy to welcome Professor Andrea Meyer, who is the co-director from the Center for Healthy Longevity at the National University of Singapore and currently leading clinical trials for longevity interventions. And we also have Veronica Brusitz, who is like a trained biomedical scientist and blockchain enthusiast who has been involved in several companies in the biotech sector and is currently the director of longevity compliance at Longevity Center. Thank you guys for making time today and joining us. And for the audience, if you have any questions to the panelists, add them in the YouTube comments, and roughly the last 10 minutes, we will select a few questions and ask them. Maybe let's directly dive into it. Longevity medicine, if you give me everybody like your 1 minute short pitch, what is it? What is longevity medicine and how is it like different from traditional medicine? Evelyn, you wanna get started?
Sure, with pleasure. So first of all, thanks so much for organizing this panel and facilitating the discussion about what is longevity medicine, what it is not, and where are we standing and what is still needed in order to have longevity medicine being actually applied in the practice, or meaning in real life. And in terms of definition, well, there is no fixed definition of longevity medicine yet, unfortunately. Hopefully this will be corrected soon. However, one might define it as AI-based precision medicine that is targeting extending the healthy lifespan. So basically targeting the aging, preventing age-related diseases, and by far not targeting solely the life extension. So it's sometimes easier to say what is longevity medicine not. So how is it different from other fields? And one of the fields is like transhumanism, so really just aiming at living forever. The name longevity might be a little bit deceiving in that sense. It's not the goal of longevity medicine to make somebody live forever, but to really extend the span of the years lived in good health. And second of all, it is a very inclusive discipline, new discipline of medicine, that is so extremely closely connected to geosciences, AI sciences, and computational sciences, and also includes a lot of other subdisciplines of clinical medicine. However, it is different, at least in my opinion, very much from what we know as preventative medicine in a sense of early detection of diseases. Since longevity medicine is rather targeting even mitigation and elimination of the risks of diseases, distinct to fields like functional, integrative, or other types of fields that have developed recently, since longevity medicine is extremely scientific, objective, and led through validation in the sense. So I think for me, these are the biggest differences that make longevity medicine distinct and evolving.
Right, that's like a lot of things that we probably will unpack in more detail in the next hour. Andrea, Veronica, what would you add from your perspective?
Look, longevity medicine is targeting aging-related conditions and symptoms. And very important, additionally to what Eva said, is by diagnosing the state of the body, and most importantly is diagnosing the biological age compared to the chronological age, and then targeting that biological age with specific interventions. And that's very important. And while doing the intervention, then measuring the biological age again. And hopefully we will talk about what is the biological age and what do you have to measure Of course, I don't want to dive now into detail, but the diagnostic part, the intervention part, and hopefully we will also talk about the intervention, what's really evidence-based, and then diagnosing again and seeing how the body reacted to the intervention is of utmost importance. And maybe I should leave it there because we will dive into all the topics.
Yes, I fully agree both with Eve and Andrea. I think that longevity medicine is currently based in the quantification of the body's and health state through the lenses of biological age and aiming to extend the health span, healthy lifespan, with various precise and evidence-based interventions that we will hopefully talk more about in this discussion.
Perfect. So maybe if I take like a few of those things out, that like longevity medicine, in a way, it's like you have like medicine coming together with like the sciences, but also like technologies like AI, and in a way measuring a lot of things that currently probably not are directly measured, like your biological age, and see how it reacts to treatments. Maybe if we start, we had like a few weeks, months back, we had like a panel on biological age with Morgan Levine and like some others, but maybe we can take that concept up again. I mean, what's the role of, or what is biological age and why is it so important in longevity medicine?
Shall I start?
Go ahead.
So our body is all the time being exposed to stressors, which means that the body, all the body systems, all the cellular systems exposed to the stressors is accumulating damage. And that damage might accumulate very differently in different organ systems and different cellular systems based on how much stressors there were, but also how good the repair is. And that will be a balance. And that's what you are measuring. By measuring the biological age. We know that there are 9 hallmarks of aging. I think there are much more. There's lots of debate how much we have, but independently, we know that there are lots of hallmarks of aging. For example, cellular senescence, we know telomere lengths, we know proteostasis, we know mitochondrial dysfunction, et cetera, et cetera. So these are more markers of how much the body was exposed to stressors and how good the repair was. Because in all these functions of the body will act differently based on the exposures. If you summarize these all, these will give a biological age, if you really drill it down to a cellular system or to a cell, but also to an organ, and then summarized as a body system. At the moment, very often we use blood as the marker of biomaterial to measure the biological age, which gives us a blood age, but we call it the biological age. And I think it's fine at the moment to do that. But what we are trying to disentangle is also how do our organs, how do they age, and is the pace of aging different in different organ systems? You might imagine that in one individual, intra-individually, the heart and the lung might not have the same pace of aging. And that is what we recently showed in a very big database of the UK Biobank, that actually the rate of aging within individuals might be different, which means that we can give different ages to all the organ systems within an individual. But what we are doing at the moment, and I think longevity medicine is really based on, which is fine because we have to find our feet in the field, is that we say, okay, we are measuring with biomaterial we have in our hands, and most often this is blood or urine or salvia. We measure the biological age and we give that number to the body of an individual. However, it might be much, much more complicated because the rate of aging is very different. And that leads, of course, to different targeted interventions. If the heart is more aging more rapidly, it might be that we have different targets, or we should target different organs differently, also based on their phenotype of the biological systems, which might be impaired.
Right, and I will jump in because I think it's one of the best explanations I have heard, right, about biological age given by Andrea. It's a very, very complex field and it's very hard to explain. So that was phenomenal. And I think it's important also to mention, since we are, you know, educating people about what is biological age not, right? So there are many, many different biological aging clocks now out there. And one has to be very prudent, since we do not have studies that may be validated to compare them all one-to-one, head-to-head. This will come, but at this very moment, it's important to discern what biological aging clocks are there more just for an informal part for the patient to, you know, you step on a scale, the scale tells you today you are 45, right? So, and a really accurate or more accurate, like deep aging clocks based on blood or on the methylation or on microbiome. And ultimately the question will be, which biological aging clock will be the best? That's a question that comes very often. And I guess here the answer is the integration of them all, as Andrea mentioned, to integrate the biological age of the entire system, but also to integrate the different clocks and to scale them so that they have one entity and give one output as well. So that ultimately we can have a biomarker that will be used in randomized controlled trials and so on, as Andrea said, for interventions, so that we can actually test interventions if they are affecting positively or maybe even negatively the biological age, and then say if an intervention is geroprotective or senolytic intervention or not.
From my scientist's point of view, it would be so amazing to actually have a way to look into the body and to see what is the state of aging, not only in our different organs and systems, but also from the perspective of different types of damage accumulation, because I also assume that different organs, different systems might age through this like portfolio, let's say, of damage with different traits as well. So that would be absolutely amazing. And I hope that one day that's where we're heading. However, right now, of course, we don't have an aging clock that we could depend on 100%. But from what I have learned from the last 2 years of working with a longevity clinic, I can see that at least from the client's perspective, it's important, because even if it's just a proxy, it gives more motivation to people to actually do something about their lifestyle. And then it's also this asset that could tell you if what you're doing is actually serving you and is changing something. So it's good enough to start doing something about your health. And for now, that's what we have. And I hope that it's going to get much, much more precise.
So when you now have those clocks and have your like patients and your individuals, how fast could you measure that change? Is it like something every month you have to take like a new clock test and get like the latest gauge of it? Or would you say your patients should like once a year or every 6 months? What's like a good time of assessing how healthy you are, how you're aging, how your change of damage is actually changing?
Do you want to start?
So that very much depends on the internet connection. So that very much depends on which clock are you using, where are you measuring. Some of the values will change faster, some of the values will change, right? So for example, for the biological age based on the blood, it doesn't really make sense to make it every week. Most of the parameters will not change. So, you know, a good frame there is probably 2 months or to 1 year. Again, depends on, are you doing something? If the patient is actually working actively on improving his or her lifestyle, then it makes sense to check maybe more often. More often means like 3 to 6 months, but for those who are actually not doing very much, not changing anything, once a year will be enough. And the photo age based on the picture that you can do with your phone that can estimate your, you know, your biological age based on picture from your face. You can do every minute if you like, because the accuracy here is relatively low. So you look at the trends. And the epigenetic clock, the frequency would be much lower. So depends very much what you are measuring and in whom. Yeah, if somebody's really changing life or the conditions are changing a lot. So we had an interesting study, if I say, where we were measuring the biological age for people before and after COVID. Right. So we saw the accelerated biological aging in those who were infected, right? So there will be moments in the life of the longevity patient journey where the biological age might change acutely, right? And then it's interesting to see, is it then flattening down? Can something be made to reverse it? It's big potential.
Yeah, I would agree. So don't measure it every week. It's also very costly. But it's now a little bit accepted that you have to do, for example, interventions where you would like to see the change at least for 4 to 6 months. And I think that's it's a good number of months to also see effect. And we also learned, of course, from the lifestyle intervention in other fields, in the public health fields, where you do, for example, an intervention of more physical activity. And if you really want to see weight change and stabilization of weight, you need at least 4 to 6 months and sometimes 12 months. So very important, I would like to add that not per se you have to do all the biological testing again, but I think we could compare a little bit what's happening in our field now to the oncology field, where we, I think, can learn so much. Like 50 years ago, we diagnosed cancer, and that's bad and that's not good. I think at the moment we can say, okay, you are looking biologically older, you already have diseases, which means, okay, the biological age is very likely to be higher. Like since around about 20 years, we can do so much phenotypic characterization of that cancer if you compare it just to oncology, where we not only know what kind of cancer it is, but also based on the epitopes, so what's inside of the cells, how possibly that patient will react to treatment, to a standardized and optimized treatment. We now are at the edge, I would say, of longevity medicine, where we know how cells are behaving, what kind of treatments they might need. And while having that very nice phenotypic characterization, we are now able to do of the human body, we then have to do interventions. And what we could track are normal pathology data every GP could actually do, because already by looking at the cholesterol, at an HbA1c, or an HDL, or an Hb, or leukocytes, so everything we can really nicely do in clinical practice, which are also a little bit cheaper, already gives us a trend if that person moves into the right direction. And of course, so we don't say, because we don't have the data, if that's cost effective to measure again the biological age. And we can do it with even phenotypic characterizations like a weight or a body composition, which is very insightful. And also there we say in all the studies using these kind of markers that at least you need 4 to 6 months until you have a change. And that's what I would suggest. Very good phenotypic screening, that you know what to do. And then of course, a more specific one to see if the intervention worked after a couple of months.
Yeah, I think cost effectiveness is a crucially important factor, especially at the current state of affairs. And 6 months is probably a reasonable time to do another biological age testing if someone's dramatically changing their lifestyle and seek to see effects. And I also agree with you, Andrea, that there is no point in measuring biological age. For example, you know you have 10 kilograms to lose. This is your biomarker that you should follow for some time, and there is no need and no reason to measure your biological age clock and spend loads of money, you know, because phenotypic one is the better option at that point.
So now that we have the capabilities like of measuring those certain some of those changes, what are like the current evidence-based interventions that really make an impact for your patients? And what would you recommend people do when they say, well, I want to start becoming healthier, I want to start tracking my biological age? How do you go about it? I mean, it's like it's easier said than done, I guess. So how do you approach that with your patients? Whoever wants to go first.
Max, you said to the first thing you said, evidence-based. The second thing you said, what would you recommend? And these are two different things, I think. Look, if we would, I'm an internal medicine specialist and geriatrician, and I love guidelines. And why do I love guidelines? Because I want to know what's out there, and I want to treat my patients in an evidence-based. That's the reason why our field needs guidelines. Even writing a guidelines where the level of evidence is expert opinion triggers a discussion that we know what to do, or at least there is an opinion written on a paper being discussed in panels, etc. So, and that's what we call EBM, evidence-based medicine. I would say that there are lots of recommendations which might not per se be evidence-based, but let's start with the evidence-based first. And I'm not sure if the audience here would like to hear them, because they are so easy to do, and we always have like 20, 30 years of evidence that it works. And that's for the ones who have a BMI greater than 22 is losing weight. Because we are, most of us, living in a Western society with unhealthy foods, etc. So we have to make sure that our body weight is in shape. And there was our body. We have to make sure that our body composition is adequate. So it's very easy to measure the body composition and look at the ratio of fat cells and muscle cells, for example. So therewith, how do you do that? Is most of the times eating a little bit less and physical exercise. I would say there is a revolution going at the moment in the dietetic field, not just saying if you are a little bit obese, lose your weight, but also for normal weight individuals, what to eat. And I think there is a milestone in the field since a couple of weeks, since we have the publication out of PLOS Medicine, really nicely showing while doing lots of meta-analysis, what kind of diet is the optimal diet compared to a Western diet. And of the researchers out of Sweden showed that if you are switching from a Western diet, where most of us, which are listening, are on, and if you go to an optimal diet composing of no red meat, a little bit, if any, white meat, a little bit, if any, fish, but lots of nuts, lots of fruit and vegetables, that we would gain around about 6 years if we would start at the age of 60. And that's a huge potential in terms of increase of lifespan. Doesn't mean that it's health span, but it's very likely that the major part is health span. And if we would start at the age of 20, that effect would be even bigger. And now we can calculate how much health span gain we would have if we would switch to a more optimal diet. And of course, now also the field switches towards what is optimal, why is it optimal? So learning what kind of fuel we give to our body, that's what eating is. Because the body is exposed to it, what is the optimal one? That we now also make very healthy foods and compositions, that the body is treated with the best ingredients, to not accumulate the damage, what I said, to disturb the hallmarks of aging. So I think this is a very interesting field. So again, look at the diet, but also physical activity. We know that's very important. I don't have to say how many steps, but it's important that you move more than you do for at least 90% of the population. We know that sleep hygiene is very important. We know that the alcohol intake should be diminished, no smoking. Look, that's all. But I think hopefully we will also touch in a second, but I will first give the floor to the others to really talk about supplements and the evidence behind that, and also repurposed drugs and the evidence behind that.
Can I just follow up on that, Andrea? I've been thinking about it as well, if like, in a way, we all talk about medicine and trying to come up with drugs, but if we as a community would really take on the food industry and say what you're producing is actually not food, it's like a bunch of chemicals mixed together that somehow taste good but don't have any nutritional value, but that would almost like be outrageous and to try to promote that, right? I mean, it's like, not to promote it, but like to get it through, to say, go to Nestle, go to Kellogg's and say what you're producing is not food. So how do we change the mindset of the of those food chemists who try to make food, but actually really don't do it? So how can we change them, or how can we get them on board into the longevity train?
Look, first of all, everybody has to understand you are what you eat. So that's important, because this is what you get into your body. Changing industries, I think, is difficult, but I think most important is improving the knowledge of the society, because if you don't buy certain ingredients in certain meals, then there is no market. And I think there is such a market already in the healthy directions. I wouldn't say that smoothies are very, very healthy, but at least there is a movement towards more biological food, etc. I think the difficult part here, and I think the opportunity, I like opportunities always, is that now we know why we age. Now we have methodologies to actually test what's good for us. And therewith we can newly shape the dietary fields and the dietetic fields, because at a certain time we really invested how much protein should you eat, etc. But everything was more directed to geriatric patients or to pediatric patients. Attention of the dietary fields. But now that we have so much knowledge about the biology, now we not only focus on how does it taste, which is most important if you're eating, but also what are the ingredients. So it's a total new area. We are also working at the National University of Singapore with a couple of partners to really now establish the knowledge about good food, because not many touch that, because nobody thought that food would be so important.
Andrea, do you think that you will be able to convince Singaporeans to quit their Milo?
Look, we are creating at the moment the most healthiest platinum food, and then we will test if somebody is going to eat it.
Well, let's see what else you're cooking up. Maybe Eva or Veronica, do you want to add something? What are your thoughts on those topics?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a scientist by background, so I am all for rejuvenation biotech and hardcore cutting edge solutions and interventions. But sadly, the answer is pretty boring for today, I'm afraid. And that's exactly what Andrea just said, because I think that our best bet and highest leverage point for most of the people right now is to apply the four pillars of healthy lifestyle, which is a good diet, exercise, sleep, and stress, or lack of it rather. And I think this is also our best bet to stay in good health for as long as possible to actually see the massive breakthroughs that I'm sure we will see in the longevity sector and aging biotech rejuvenation. And yeah, I think that's what we should all put more attention to. And the biggest gap I see is actually the gap between the knowledge that we have from research, from the science field, from the evidence-based medicine, and the implementation. This is the biggest gap, and for many people, for most of the people really, this is the most difficult to actually bridge and to do the things and to implement the things that are good for you and that would allow you to stay healthier for longer.
And from my side, I would like to add that one might think that all those interventions that were just mentioned and that I fully agree are the core of what has to happen in a longevity medicine journey with a patient to have a good basis, a decent fundament to then maybe implement further geroprotective and senolytic treatments. I think the difference here is, again, the AI empowerment. So any one of us can do intermittent fasting, can do exercise, can do, you know, proper nutrition. It's a totally different field. It's a very difficult field to tackle because of all the misinformation on smart foods that are out there. But the point here is we can implement wearables, devices, tracking, and AI right now to actually optimize the interventions that were just mentioned to an individual so that they actually work. So intermittent fasting is not the same for everybody, but it's been shown in studies to have an effect on the health span and the lifespan, a positive one, right, in humans. So with a tracker of intermittent fasting, with the timings that include the circadian rhythm of the patient, the lactate production of the patient, and so on, we can actually see if the intermittent fasting that he's applying or she's applying is an intermittent fasting or not. And many patients would be surprised that the intermittent fasting they are doing is at best caloric restriction, which is also good, but not as effective. Same goes for exercise, for muscle building, for sarcopenia prevention, and so on. And I will touch the painful field, right, on the supplements and their validation, evidence, and their repurposed drugs, because I think it's important to talk about it. And it's important also to first of all mention that the protocols are not there. They are at best anecdotal, right? So how much you take of what is not written in any guideline, and recommendations are at best you know, coming from one person for which it worked in some other way. So experience based, you know, case study, which is great for those people who benefit from it, but should not be copied by masses, right? So this is because it can be dangerous. So I see patients coming to me and say, we are, first of all, we are healthy and we are already on all the best supplements. Now show us what you can do better. And, you know, I'm then detecting easily that through NAD boosters, they actually developed hyperuricemia, so very high uric acid and bottom line kidney failure and et cetera, right? Rapamycin, mTOR inhibitor or other derivatives of those. Clearly mTOR pathway is one of the aging pathways, but we will see once we have enough biomarkers and can conduct enough validating studies which of those medications, repurposed drugs, supplements, and then hopefully also by the time senolytics that are now in trials, phase one, phase two, phase 2b, will actually be safe and effective. Right. So, yeah, so much from my side.
I mean, Evelyn, you just hit like on a few points that that I want to bring up anyway. It's like we now have like in a way those lifestyle interventions like good food, sport, sleep, less stress. So once this is a lot of people start incorporating that and have like this basic natural health line that you can get to that, what are like the next cool interventions that are currently like still like more like in the science, maybe not questionable, but like maybe like a little bit more futuristic, or like just like currently tested out to see how they act? You just mentioned NAD boosters have side effects. Rapamycin seems to be hitting like a mTOR and a delay aging, but there's like no or not many clinical studies yet on what it really does to aging, when you should start. Where do you see this entire field of like experimental geroscience currently going? And when do you think we have like data on that, on like those health in a pill like solutions?
Optimistically, I hope we are not talking about several years. We're talking about probably, double number to get a proper validation and things developed. I don't think we will only see pharmacotherapy, so not only pills, supplements, analytics, compounds, but we will see some other interventions, on the apheresis base. I'm open usually to most of the interventions unless they are really clearly harmful, because first, do no harm. But other than that, I'm always very curious. So I think there is some potential now in those interventions that are beyond pills. And I think those will be the first ones that will be validated once we have enough biomarkers and population set of patients and probands, so like the study participants to be validated. In terms of senolytics and germ protectors, I think here the new ones that are developed from scratch would probably take over the repurposed drugs that are right now in the field. Very curious about metformin, what will be shown, from trials like by Professor Barzilai. And I think last but not least, also some of the genetic therapies and treatments will probably have a space as one of the first ones again to be trialed and validated. Yeah.
Andrea, you want to follow up on that? What's happening with intervention
studies? Yeah, look, luckily there are lots of groups now looking for trials and do it in a way that the methodology is sound. So having a control group, doing it randomized control, so one group is getting a placebo, the other's not, to take really all the factors like lifestyle factors into account, to really see what the effect of that supplement of that pill is. So that's very important. And I think we have to raise the bar a little bit in our field that we want certain quality. But very excitingly, there are groups, an increasing number of researchers who are now doing the trial. On the other hand side, I think we also have to face reality. And the reality is that lots of individuals already taking lots of over-the-counter drugs. For example, resveratrol, spermidine, NMN, AKG, etc. And the list is very, very long, with the promise while selling it that you will be younger. So I think that means that we have to speed up, that we can really claim that longevity medicine in the end is evidence-based. Because at the moment, if we call selling supplements, this is not evidence-based. And it might even, as Eva said, is harmful. So we have to speed up and get our act together because otherwise our field might be a big bubble. And there will be not an explosion, but an implosion, because we really do not sell what is worthwhile, the money, and might be harmful. So, but we also have to react to that enormous amount of supplements already over the counter And we might also have to do pragmatic trials where we test individuals before they take any drugs, or even if they already take drugs, and test again to at least know, or give the participant the opportunity to give them the opportunity to see if it's working or not in just one marker, for example, the biological age, and give a little bit of a safe haven to do it, because they will already do it. And now it's in a very uncontrolled way. So in summary, I think this is an emerging field. We really have to get much more evidence-based data out there, do very good trials, and accept that it might be that 8 out of the 10 trials we are doing will be super negative and somebody else has to replicate it, but then we know it's negative. And then we can send out the message that don't take it at the moment. It will not work, or it's very likely that it's not working. But then focusing on the ones who are working and fine-tuning it, as Eva said, with to personalize it with AI, with lots of biomarkers, to find the right recipe for the right client at the right time.
Yeah, I think it's it is a bit dangerous, because people want things to work. People want to believe that they would get younger, and there is so much promise in many substances out there that it's probably overpromised, basically, as Andrea was saying. And I personally think that we should be very careful messing with metabolism. Even if it's just one substance, I don't believe that there will be a single bullet for aging ever. I don't subscribe to that, that hypothesis in general. However, I'm sure that there is also a lot of potential in the field of supplements, and that there will be many substances that in some way would be able to change the trajectory or the pace of aging. But yes, I can only agree with both Eve and Andrea that we definitely need more evidence and more trials, high quality trials, to actually know what's good and if it's good and for whom and when and how to take it and when to take it and so on and so forth. So it seems like it's already here, it is, but at the same time, it's still not here, and we will need a lot of work to actually get there.
I mean, given that there's like so much, people start talking more about longevity, but a lot of people are like not very patient and would like to have like a certain pills right now, right? And in a way, try it out on themselves, right? It's like without the supervision of a doctor, right? I think there's like this entire biohacker space out there. They're like biohacker conferences. Like I said, they use like some over the counter medicines that you can get on the black market. Some are supplements that like you just can get anywhere, but we don't know what they do, or even like what the combination of those things do. What's your message to those? Because I mean, those people are in a way, they're like very interested in longevity medicine, but they just want to have it in a way faster and outside of the clinic. But I probably would be very interested to get data from them, right? In a way, when you take like 4 different pills together, how does it affect your metabolism, or do you actually like live longer? How would you approach this scene of biohacking, and how is that actually very different from what longevity medicine is?
I would say be careful, but if you do it, at least collect the data, at least quantify yourself, because there are many people who would do it anyway because they want to, they are impatient or they are so into it. But so yes, at least collect data, at least measure yourself and write down everything. But regarding the biohacking field, I think there is also this one difference between people who are strictly interested in longevity and people who are interested in biohacking per se, because many biohackers are also interested in optimizing their performance, not just their health span. And there's a big difference, because in the longevity sector, we are more focused on optimizing everything, including the lifestyle, towards health span. So living as long as possible in the best health possible. When you're optimizing for performance, whether it's with exercise and different exercising protocols or substances that you're taking or interventions that you're applying, there's a difference, because what's good for your performance might not be so good for your long-term health in that regard.
How, Eva, Andrea, how do you feel about that?
Okay, I can maybe jump in. I would not exactly, as a physician, I would not advise biohackers on anything unless they actually ask me, which I don't think would ever happen, because they like to experiment. So, and we might have, you know, very distinct opinions on what is the immediate effect on you know, longevity interventions, as they would say. Look, if they are looking for something with short-term outcomes, okay. But in longevity, especially when we are talking about the supplements, let's say NAD boost, it is something for decades. So taking even, you know, 5 grams of it will not exactly give you a better outcome. So, you know, look at it as an investment. You're investing in your later decades of life. And it's the same like in the bank. You put a money amount of there, and with every year you will get a very small percentage. It will not exactly help you to increase the percentage if you will constantly do something with this money and touch it and shift it. So similar to that, if you will constantly try out on your body whatever there is, you might get lucky and it will, you know, you will have some positive effect, but in most of the cases you won't. And you know, and if you are already experimenting on yourself, then at least try to have at least some professional that will look at your data, so that you will prevent damage that might be also permanent to your body. Again, I'm bringing here liver failure and kidney failure that can happen with RAPA and mTOR inhibitors. These are cancer drugs, right? So even low dose, what we say is low dose for cancer patients might be an overdose for a patient that is not in need of mTOR inhibitor. So if you are experiment at least with a professional that would agree to double check if you are not causing a lot of harm to yourself.
No further comments. I think most important, you're in charge of your body. If you take risks, it's your responsibility, and have somebody involved who knows more maybe than you about the body's physiology, and test. Be careful.
Okay, be careful, says the doctor. Listen to that. Don't die young by trying out risky things. Maybe I want to, we like have 12 minutes left, and I want to tackle two things in a way. One is like technologies for longevity medicine. Eva was talking earlier about like precision medicine and artificial intelligence, but also like with VitaDAO, we're like very like in the blockchain space and with data. How do you see like that being integrated on the back end in a way of longevity medicine, that you have access as a patient to your data even without your doctor being there? How does it store securely, that it's at the same time can be used like to train AIs that give you become better over time and give you better insights through precision medicines? How do you think those fields should interact more?
Should I go first? So in general, in terms of data, I'm coming from academia, and I think in terms of studies and then ultimately guidelines and application of patients. So for us, the more data, the better. And at the same time, involvement of patients in their journey is very important. So having them accessing their own data is, of course, very important. Now, the point here is, as Andrea mentioned before, the methodology, right? So having all those data is great and fantastic, but then using the data is then yet another step. And those are very different. In terms of ethics and safety, you know, here probably I have no big comments. I tried not to engage in those debates, but purely for the science, it's I think collaboration is always good, and especially with the fields that are allowing collection of data and storing them in a place that is accessible for different parties that are involved in the purposeful way of using them.
Veronica, you're excited about blockchain as well. How do you look at that? Sorry, and then Andrea.
Absolutely. I think data is really precious and valuable, and the potential to employ blockchain in order to improve our ownership of data as individual is super exciting. So for sure, I agree. And I think this technology can be used for the benefit of the longevity field and its growth. So yes, totally. I agree with that hypothesis.
Yeah, I think it's such an evolving business, or the opportunities to have data are so evolving that we are overwhelmed, I would say, at the moment of data. And what we as scientists have to do, or industry partners, to make data digestible. So what does it actually mean? Look, lots of persons measure their sleep. But how much deep sleep, how much REM sleep, and what sequence do you actually need? How can you do your own interventions to modify it in a way that it makes sense for you, that it's not just the heartbeat the Apple Watch is giving you or other devices? So data are beautiful, and I love to digitally phenotype my participants as much as possible. I think digital phenotyping is the most important keyword I'm using since a couple of years, because measuring is really what we have to do, measuring physiology, not just steps. That's what we did 10 years ago. But now also not just the heartbeats, but also the blood pressures and other very pressure things, like even ketone level, only glucose level. We can measure glucose levels 24/7 already since 10 years or 15 years. So now is the time, because we can measure it. The devices are there. They're out there in the public space. Now we have to make it digestible to the audience, that they know what to do with it, to really empower individuals to change, for example, lifestyle. They own their data, because if you don't know what it is, you cannot own them, because then it's no point of selling them to somebody. And I think it's very important that the client or the individual owns the data, and that we have to empower them. And hopefully that we get ethics as researchers access to these data to make sense out of it, to really predict when the physiological systems need help from dietary intakes of a little bit more physical activity or a stress intervention, etc. And I think we now have the technologies who can already predict, for example, if somebody has an infection, or if there was the heart rate is going up, the temperature a little bit, that we can prevent major events in life, which we couldn't do 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So devices to every bodily systems, please go for it.
So this is in a way interesting, that like with all those devices, everybody has a phone, rings, watches, some part of longevity medicine is already amongst the consumers, right? And could help them. At the same time, there's like this other part of longevity medicine where you still have to see your doctor and pay like a lot of money for the tests and the consultation and other things. So what's the game plan here? How do we make longevity medicine like accessible to everyone? Is it like, are we targeting the direct consumers, or are we going over insurances and tell them, hey, if you change your view on medicine and on insuring and health in general, then you will make more money and we get more data and people will be healthier and the world will be better? Or how do we, in a way, what's the commercial aspect and the spreading aspect of that? How do we get there?
These are five questions in one.
Pick the one you want to answer.
Maybe start with the variables and what consumers can already learn and what they can do. Look, it's questionable if we sell it as longevity medicine. So this is public health. So even weighing machines, we are measuring weight at home. That's already maybe not a variable you have, but at least you can measure it already and you can take action. So I think what the longevity medicine is doing, synthesize the data to then make it very explicit and individualize it, what an individual should do. And it should not be restricted to the richest of the richest, who can see a doctor very specialized. And there are not many out there longevity medicine specialists. Even the term doesn't exist. Look at it, it exists in our vocabulary. But if I would go to the Society of Internal Medicine, where I am part of, my member, they would say, you are not right. I think I don't know what you are. So there's a non-existence of longevity medicine in the regulatory system yet. But we are working on that. So that's very important. But it should not be restricted to the richest. But I think is very often medicine changes and medicine starts with specific groups. And it might be likely that the ones who want to pay for it will be the earliest adopters who already have devices, who will learn how their body react with the help of physicians, because it's not yet in the insurance system. So that's also the reason why wellness clinics, for example, who try to sell longevity medicine are popping up everywhere. Which is quite, I will use the word, it's quite dangerous, because there's no quality control. So you don't know what you get for your money. I don't claim that anybody here has the recipe, because we don't have that, but we need at least an open discussion, what's good and what might be harmful, and where are certain edges, what you do not sell. So in the end, which is my hope on my KPI for myself, is that longevity medicine, which is an evidence-based approach based on the biological phenotype of somebody, which we diagnose, intervene, and then measure again, will be implemented in internal medicine in the next coming 5 years. This is only possible if we have the right diagnostic tools and we have the right interventions in place. We don't need the interventions yet per se, because we know that there are neurologists specialized in dementia. We don't have a treatment yet, but we have lots of diagnostics because we understand it. So I think there is a very good business case for longevity medicine to be implemented in regular care very, very soon. And that's what AFA, for example, myself with others, are implementing and trying to achieve at the moment. Next to that, because that was your second thing, is where is the business case? Where can we make money? Look, the industry is exploding at the moment, making money, because everybody knows that you will have much more hours and days to gain. And you know that you will live until 90 years of age, and it's very likely. And how do you become and stay healthy? And there are lots of industry partners acting in this field to achieve that. And there are lots of clients. Of course, if we assume that aging is a disease, which we are going to treat, then 100% of the population from a certain age onwards has that disease, and there's a huge market.
7 billion people market. We're almost on top of the hour. Veronica, I know you have to jump off. What insights do you want to share with us on that?
Again, I totally agree with Andrea. I think there is potentially a huge market because who doesn't want to be healthy and live long in good health? So the question is this market is already matured enough for for many businesses to take on and to make money? I think it's already getting there. And we can see that from more and more places showing up and offering interventions and longevity medicine. And I can see this as a definitely as an increasing trend because the industry is booming. We have never been in a better place in terms of knowledge and opportunities. So I think that the future is really bright for that sector.
Awesome. Eva, anything you want to add?
No, I'm 100% with Andrea, and that's I share the same exact KPI. I'm also an internist, and my dream and my goal and whatever I can do, I will also contribute to see longevity medicine being a part of it, being driven by evidence and credibility, and purely on science. Whatever business there is around it, it's already very secondary.
Perfect. Then thank you, Andrea, Evelyn, and Veronica. Any last words that you want to share? I mean, I know all of you are like active in the longevity space. Anything you want to promote? Anything cool that's upcoming? Any last words?
The future is bright.
Yes, the health span has to be full of quality.
Now I feel like I should give you some, some good quote as the last person. But I do believe that the future is bright for our sector, and I am really happy. I'm actually really happy to be here on this panel and to be talking to you guys. I am happy that we have this conversation, that we are in this point where we are talking about these things and there is more and more to talk about, because I feel like we are on the same mission. We want to end age-related diseases, and I truly believe that this is where we are all going.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And I think also like laughter and a good smile is also like a nice way of ending a panel. And to the audience, thanks for tuning in. And we will have more panels in the future. Have a good day, everyone. Bye-bye.
So much,
thank
Mark.
You. Bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you.